Hi there, welcome to another episode of Mom's the Word with myself, Arifa, and Nuzha.
Hi everyone, it's Nuzha. I'm happy to be back here for today's episode.
Awesome. Today we've got an incredible guest with us who's going to be speaking about something that's very, very current at the moment, although it's been going on ongoing for about more than 70 years. So today we've got this incredible doctor with us. His name is Yusuf El Tahami. Got it correct now. And he's going to be talking about the Palestinian crisis that's on, you know, that's happening at the moment, but it's an ongoing thing. And he's he's going to be covering the crisis, which has been going on for a long time, but it's obviously been more current with since Ramadan and since, you know, the kind of occupation of Al-Aqsa Masjid more recently. Well, yeah. More so, and the conflict that's been happening now, and it's ongoing, unfortunately. So thank you so much, Yusuf, for joining us today. I really appreciate you taking your time out from your busy schedule to be with us and to speak about the Palestinian issue, crisis, genocide, apartheid.
Yeah, we talk about the semantics around the issue. I think a lot of the time on social media, you find more informed debate and critique surrounding issues, especially when it comes to journalism and reports on how different like political issues are reported around the world. And I think we just wanted to ask Yusuf, if for anyone who isn't as like, I guess, it depends. Some people say you can be on Twitter and understand it, which I think is a great app and stay informed, but not everyone is on it. So, or not everyone is as like, as I guess, informed on all the different types of critiques that are there, especially when they're just trying to keep up to date. So if you could introduce yourself as well to us, Yusuf, and how you describe the work that you do.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here and share some of the stuff that I've learned. So I'm Yusuf. I'm a junior doctor in London. I have a special interest. I've done work on domestic health inequalities and a special interest in global health inequality as well. And like a lot of people over, you know, the Ramadan period, as you saw the violence that happened in Gaza and in Al-Aqsa Mosque and in Palestine, obviously my interest, or, you know, my desire to learn more about what's happening, which I think a lot of people shared, kind of prompted me to look into something that I didn't really look into before, which is obviously, so as we know, with every war that happens in Gaza, as, you know, bombs are dropped, etc., we know the health impact that has. We know the number of people that have died. We know the number of people that have been injured. We know the hospitals that have been destroyed or damaged, etc., etc. However, from a health perspective, I knew next to nothing, really, on what the health system in Palestine looks like. What are the health problems facing Palestinians on a day-to-day basis? And what those mean for people living there and living under occupation and under oppression in Palestine. So it sort of prompted some research, and I'm really happy to be here to share that. And then the question was about the genocide, right? About conflict.
Is it a genocide? Is it a crisis? How do we kind of, it's a matter of semantics and the debate continues. So shed some light on that, because I'm sure people are listening to this and thinking, oh my gosh, you know, it's
I think the argument comes from this idea that when you use words like conflict, you create this equality between two sides, okay? It feeds into this narrative that there are both sides that are on equal footing, that there are two states that are fighting and jostling for power. For example, like you could see with India and Pakistan, okay? Two independent states that are, you know, nuclear powers in their own right, and they have, you know, military force and, you know, control of all their borders, etc., and they're jostling for power. Whereas what's happening in Palestine is very, very different. So the Israeli government is a nuclear power, and it's occupying the West Bank, and it's besieging Gaza, which are the two places of sort of Palestinian quote-unquote governance. So they're not two sides. They're not equal. In fact, it's one side with all of the military might, with all of the military power, with control over security, over borders, over supplies, over electricity, over water, that is oppressing individuals that have been there for centuries, for generations and generations. So it's, I guess that's where the critique of the word conflict sort of comes from, and that's why I tend to avoid using it. But I think at the end of the day, you know, when we're talking about something such as Palestine, there are so many things, so many ways that you can sort of look into this problem, look into what's happening, that, you know, getting caught up about a specific word isn't necessarily the most important thing.
I think what you can say is within discussions within the communities, it perhaps might not be a priority, but what it looks like towards, I guess, Western, like in journalism, because everything is so calculated and every word matters and there's a lot of money going into it, you know, the amount of the words that they use have so much impact. So I get what you mean. And it's interesting to see how everyday people report or discuss issues can also, we're expected to also meet the standard of actual journalism or like, you know, academic papers, which of course is important to be correct, like as a sense of being correct, I guess, which I understand has great importance, but it does sometimes does potentially take away from like certain discussions. But I'm of the belief that, you know, adopting language that, you know, reflects accurately or more, you know, accurately of a situation is much better. I think a lot of people are aware of, to some degree, of what's happening, and I guess the history behind the apartheid and how it came about, and it's a very long one. I feel like I've learned a lot definitely in the last few weeks. But I guess what would you say is the most, like in terms of a health perspective of what's happening in the occupied territory, how has the medical context kind of looked like? I guess especially with COVID occurring, like what is that looking like in occupied Palestine, and what has medical care looked in the past? What is kind of the relationship between I guess foreign aid and the healthcare structure within Palestine, I guess, if you have anything, if you want to shed light on that.
So I think, you know, talking about the history of Palestine can take all year, I could talk forever about it. I think when there's any big sort of problem in history, it's always helpful to go and look what the British did, and work from there. So Britain controlled Palestine after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. It was just called Palestine. It was a territory in the Ottoman Empire and became part of the British Mandate of Palestine. In 1947, Britain left, so it decided to leave the governance of Palestine. And in 1948, there was a war between Israel and the Arab states that surrounded it, which resulted in the beginnings of the map that we see now. And essentially what this map shows is a West Bank and a Gaza Strip that are Palestinian, quote-unquote, Palestinian territories. And you have Israel, which is the rest of the land that was historically Palestine. In those places since then, Gaza is under Palestinian sort of governance. However, it's besieged from land, air, and sea. So on one border with Israel, the other border with Egypt, which prevents medical, which prevents supplies from coming in. They control everything that comes in and out of that place. And then in the West Bank, there is a de facto arrangement between Israel and what's called the Palestinian Authority. And the Palestinian Authority is what governs Palestinians in the West Bank. And this includes healthcare. So it's a very unique dynamic because you have one occupier, okay, which historically, so before the mid-90s, Israel was in charge of providing care, healthcare to Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza, in the occupied Gaza. So it wasn't until the mid-90s with the Oslo Accords that then transitioned to the Palestinian Authority. However, Israel still collects taxes for the Palestinian Authority and then gives them to the Palestinian Authority. It still has a huge amount of influence in terms of the Palestinian Authority's budget and therefore how much money the Palestinian Authority can spend on healthcare. It has enormous influence on things like water, electric supply, essentials for working in a hospital or a healthcare service. Of course, and we can talk about further on about what the impact of that has on people living in Palestine in terms of, the realities of living and trying to access healthcare in an occupied state. So that's kind of like a very quick rush through the history of, the Palestinian health service. Okay, so it only came about really quite recently, so the mid-90s. It's very, very fragmented, much like the Palestinian people, unfortunately. The healthcare system is very fragmented. So you have multiple organizations trying to provide healthcare. You have a national health insurance system, which is run by the Ministry for Health in Palestine, in the Palestinian Authority. And that provides a sort of base level, I don't want to call it inadequate, well, it is inadequate, a base level inadequate level of healthcare for patients, for people who have that insurance. And then you also have large NGOs that can provide, either hospitals or medical care or, primary care clinics. And you have the UNRWA, which is the Relief Works Agency, the UN Relief Works Agency, which looks after the 750,000 refugees that are placed in the West Bank. So a very fragmented health system. This creates problems in terms of coordinating people, in terms of, unifying a specific health vision of addressing, problems across the board. And it makes it incredibly difficult to actually govern a health program there. And then on top of that, certain things are just absolutely missing. So there's no primary care system in Palestine. There's a huge shortage of, primary care physicians. There's also a huge shortage of psychiatrists. I think there's, close to zero, maybe I recall 10 psychiatrists for the entirety of Palestine. Mental health infrastructure is essentially absent. It just doesn't exist. So there's huge problems that are faced with the Palestinian health system. And this is before you throw in a pandemic in the mix and all of the problems that creates for health systems across the world.
That was a brilliant summary, I guess. Yeah, no, I'm more assuming it's an already overwhelmed system, given how much occurs on a daily basis with different, because you said it's land, water and sea, and there's so many structural issues that come into place when it comes to accessing healthcare and the health of these individuals. I guess, I think you've given us a good history. Like, that was really, really great. I don't think I would, when I looked at the question, I was like, this is going to take, I wouldn't even be able to answer any of that as comprehensively as you did. But I guess what we wanted to look at today is the kind of the breakdown of the conditions right now in occupied Palestine. So what is the emergency care? What does, a woman what does maternal care look like? We don't have to go into everything. I think you've touched upon it, but I guess because this is a maternal health-based podcast and also maybe having a later shedding some light on COVID, because I think that would be a very interesting dynamic to put on it. But yeah, what is it? What does it look like right now?
So it's difficult. So when I was doing my reading and my research, it's very fragmented and all over the place. Because there isn't one authority that's looking after all of the health of Palestinians, you're getting information from lots of different sources. And sometimes it's dated, sometimes it's recent. So it can be hard to get a very accurate sort of up-to-date sort of statistics You know, I feel like we're spoiled here in the UK, having, you know, the Office of National Statistics giving you absolutely everything. You just need to type it into the website. However, what we do know is that there are certain things that Palestinians face that I don't think, you know, many people or any people across the world actually encounter. So one of the biggest things is checkpoints. Okay. And this is really important for both Palestinians living in the West Bank and Palestinians living in Gaza. So the way that Israel has chosen to segregate itself from Palestinians and from Palestine from the is to build walls, literal separation walls with checkpoints, preventing people from crossing. Okay. Unfortunately, in order to access medical treatment, people will frequently have to pass these checkpoints, sometimes multiple, in order to get them. So, for example, for maternal health, there have been many births that have happened at checkpoints. So imagine, you know, you're on your birth certificate, okay? You're putting down, like, the place of birth was the checkpoint. That's, you know, in between one town or the next. And these are not in between Israel and Palestine. It's between Palestinian towns, okay? So, and specifically between Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, and other parts of Palestine. So a study showed, research into it showed that 10% of women in labor were forced to wait more than 2 hours at checkpoints, okay? So, you know, it's not difficult to try and just picture that, you know, picture being in the middle of labor, okay, being asked to get out of the ambulance for the ambulance to be searched. You're, you know, there's contractions happening. You're in active labor. Potentially, the baby could be born at any moment. And yet you're being forced to wait. Just the dehumanization of that itself is traumatizing, but also the physical health impact of that as well. So you're delaying medical treatment, you're delaying medical examination as well, that could potentially save that woman's child or her own life. So there are complications that have come secondary to delays that have happened because of pregnant women waiting at checkpoints. So that's one example. Another example is in terms of, outcomes in labor. So women in Palestine face much, worse outcomes, in terms of, mortality, in childbirth than just across in Israel itself. And, across every sort of speciality, there are issues that have come about because of this systemic control over Palestinians and also oppression of them. So preventing people from going to be with their family via the use of permits, the problems with in Gaza. So this is mainly the West Bank, but, you know, looking at Gaza itself, you know, women, children, mothers, whatever, all of them die indiscriminately when you drop a bomb in such a tightly, densely packed area. And, you know, even if they manage to evacuate, then their house is destroyed. And you can imagine the health impact of having someone's house being destroyed, say, you know, a pregnant woman or just anyone having their house destroyed has huge impacts on their mental health, on their physical health, on their stress. All of those things have a huge impact.
I think itself, you could argue, I kind of say it like this, it's like, while bombs and guns are a form of warfare, I think denying access to healthcare in itself is a form of warfare against a group of people, isn't it? Because if you don't, like, I think that in itself is a war tactic. Like, I just see it as that, because there's no other, if you completely deny people access to healthcare, it doesn't even allow them the energy and strength to fight. That's what I think about. I don't know. It kind of comes to mind is when you're trying to build a resistance, like the basic things, the basic necessities that you need, even if it's like houses and whatnot, even just to stay alive, living and breathing and in a healthy mental state, in itself is another like form of oppression that, you know, I guess it's not overlooked, but it's another angle to, I guess, look at it. It's, you know, if you're denying a woman to like safely give birth to a child, the next generation of Palestinians, then that is a form of violence, and that is a form of, you know, it's part of the violence, I guess. Yeah,
it's essentially an attack on the human rights, isn't it? That's what it is. It's healthcare, and access to healthcare is, you know, a right to every individual, and that's essentially what they're doing, just kind of violating your human rights, as we already know, in so many ways, and healthcare being one of them, really. Yeah. In fact, I'm going to pick up on that. So you rightly mentioned, you know, that it's insane the way mothers have been treated, the way children, you know, there's a higher risk of stillbirths and losing, you know, miscarriages and stillbirths, and also losing mothers, because it's not just about losing babies, but also bleeding because, and other health complications that may occur as a result of not being seen, yeah, on time, and being catered to the needs of the mothers. I had a question in terms of also the physical and mental health aspect. So in terms of young people that are witnessing war, so I know adults and young people, but young people that are growing, you know, have been growing up in this conflict, in this warfare, in this genocide, in this apartheid, what are the long-term implications on the physical and mental health and well-being of young people witnessing the war, and how does it affect them? Yeah, so long-term implications affecting them, you know, in later life, perhaps. Would you be able to kind of shed some light on that?
Yeah, so it's genuinely terrifying. I think, like, when reading these statistics and understanding the impact of them on individuals. So when you know, when I'm faced with statistics, you know, it's easy to just look at the numbers, okay? But when you're faced with a statistic that says that 93% of Palestinian children regularly feel threatened, feel a lack of security, and feel fear, okay, that should make every person, anyone with a heart, to feel just, you know, overwhelming sorrow. So that's 93% of children. It's not that feel intermittent threatening or secure or lack of security or fear. I'm sure every child at some point feels afraid, but to feel regularly afraid, and 93% of children in Palestine feel that. So if that doesn't answer your question about, you know, what are some of the long-term implications of, you know, young people's mental health, that should say it all. Furthermore, when you looked at sort of a analysis of the children in Gaza, right, especially after the last war, 43% of children suffer a diagnosis, have a concrete diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, okay? And this is a diagnosis that is not easily resolved. It can often be lifelong that you suffer from this. So it's a huge crisis, and it's only going to get worse as, you know, this current generation of children who've seen this current bombardment in Gaza, for example, the impact that will have. More statistics. So in terms of teens, 80% of all teenagers in Palestine have witnessed shootings, and 39% have seen killings secondary to shootings or bombings. So that's, you know, that's close to half of teenagers have seen someone being killed, being murdered, often by state forces. So it's the impact is huge, and unfortunately, the infrastructure is just not there to deal with these long-term mental health impacts. And secondary to the stress caused by them and the link between mental and physical health, there are, of course, going to be physical health consequences too.
Yeah, so just picking up on the PTSD, so even if the children were to be fortunate enough to, come out of the conflict, you know, flee the conflict or migrate to neighbours, across the borders to other neighbouring countries, the PTSD, it will be a long-term issue. So even if they were to get a job or try to, you know, study or you know, try and develop themselves, I guess it will take a lot longer to do so, to pick up on skills that somebody who hasn't seen the conflict or crisis or hasn't seen such warfare or guns and violence to pick up on. And I feel like that's really something wild, really. Like, it's a long-term issue, even if they were no longer in the crisis, you know, if they were no longer at home in Palestine, if they were gone to Jordan or Turkey or anywhere else, and moving there, migrating there to better their lives, or, you know, parents or families taking their children across borders, refugee camps, all this kind of stuff, kind of that to better your life. But because you're constantly living with PTSD, there's only so much
remedy,
I guess. What's the word?
You can kind of remedy it, because it's a long, I guess, yeah, what you're trying remedy. To say is that yes, you can like, obviously, with every type of I guess mental health, like, I think we see it in the perspective of the UK, like, you experience something horrible but you remedy the situation over time. But this is something that, especially with young children, and it's like all of them have experienced it at the same time, I think it fundamentally disturbs the architecture of their brain and how they function in life. They're never going to recover, and that's just some of these children will never recover, and that's a fact. That damage has been irreversible. Like, wounds can heal, like, all these stuff can heal, but the psychological trauma of it all, no matter how much therapy or advice or like whatever happens, that's still going to be there. They're still always going to hold that pain, and this is what you said, wherever they move ever. Yeah, I get what you're saying.
And it's not just seeing the bullets, right? It's also seeing people dying around you. It's also seeing people, your own family, losing family members, mothers, fathers, siblings, families, you know, that's like it's not just the violence that you're seeing, but the people also losing that. So it's grief on top of that as well. Like, there's violence that you see on TV and we're like, okay, we need to kind of, when you're watching films or horror, you know, horror stories or films and stuff, and they rate it as 12 or 15 or whatever. But then there's actual seeing it in, you know, flesh and blood, you know, you're actually there in reality and having to deal with that and all the emotional consequences and all the kind of, like you said, Nisa, the architecture of your brain changing, that is having like a major implication for later on. So yeah, that's really interesting. That's really interesting. But I also wanted to ask about
I just wanted to say that yes, absolutely. Yeah. I think that for lots of people, that like they'll never be rid of it. Okay, you know, just to give a bit of, you know, comparison, the occurrence of PTSD in the UK, the prevalence is around 3%. So compare that with 40% of children with signs and symptoms of PTSD. It's, you know, it's you know, more than 10 times. So just providing a little bit of extra context in terms of, you know, how frequent PTSD is. So PTSD is not just an acute stress reaction. So acute stress reactions are normal. It's, you know, when you're under a huge amount of stress, when you see something like, you know, someone being murdered in front of you or a family member, you know, dying or whatever, you know, it's normal to have a reaction to that. What's, you know, if you want to go down sort of a neurological and neuropsychiatry route about changing the architecture of the brain, you know, that's what happens with PTSD, is that, you know, they can't just move on. They can't just, there's difficulty in processing the violence that has been seen and the trauma that's been experienced, that means that, you know, that person is stuck with that for at least a very long time, and only will get better with sort of quite intensive therapy with, you know, with mental health infrastructure that just doesn't exist in Palestine, unfortunately. So it's, you know, one way of looking at it is that, you know, there's Israel is inflicting these wounds, both physical and mental, and there's very little support to treat the consequences of them or to treat them at all. It's genuinely one of the more difficult things to really think about, to understand that, you know, nearly half of children suffer from a serious mental health condition secondary to this trauma.
And also moving on to the recent COVID pandemic, how is that having an implication? What kind of implication is that having there? Because of course they've already, like you mentioned earlier, there's already issues surrounding the healthcare system there and accessibility to that for the Palestinians in the country, but also in the state, but also in terms of something that I read recently, in fact, was that Israel is trying, you know, doing really well in terms of vaccines. So Israel's vaccine success has been widely lauded by the US media. So please, you know, shed some light on the COVID vaccination story in Palestine, because obviously Israel was succeeding, no surprise there. But Palestine, unfortunately, is on, you know, there's a completely different story.
Yeah, so it looks like around 60%, up to 60% of Israelis are now vaccinated, fully vaccinated, so that's two doses, which is an incredible feat of achievement for the, you know, the public health provision there in that country. However, yes, you look just across, separation wall, and it goes to 5% of Palestinians that are fully vaccinated. And that statistic, you know, the huge disparity there is really telling. So Israel has repeatedly said that it's not our legal responsibility due to the Oslo Accords. It's not our legal responsibility to look after the health of, you know, the Palestinians. That's their problem. However, when you look at how much control Israel has over, healthcare in Palestine, it really doesn't hold that strongly, and it definitely doesn't make sense from a public health perspective either, of having, you know, populations that are close to each other, and yet one is pretty much protected, nearly pretty much protected with herd immunity almost from COVID, whereas the other is extremely vulnerable. And one of the things that sort of just shows how segregated these communities are, in the sense that Palestinians that have any interaction with Israeli citizens will get vaccinated. But then their relatives and the people that they live with and the people in their neighborhood and their community will not. And this kind of injustice generally across the world in terms of vaccines is huge, and it's got a huge impact, but particularly, you know, it's very vivid and in Palestine.
Brilliant. And in terms of like the only testing center, so most recently the only testing center in Gaza was bombed, and how are they now testing people for COVID? So obviously there's been there's been issues already, and there's already hospital sites that are, there are very few hospital sites anyway, and access to healthcare, access to hospitals, access to medical assistance is very limited for people in Palestine. So the only testing center being bombed is obviously pushing them even further behind than they are in terms of vaccines and in terms of actually kind of diagnosing people
scaling the issue as well. You can't even scale the issue if you can't even figure out how many people have COVID. So how are they dealing with that, I guess?
So thankfully, the testing center that was bombed, or was damaged, thankfully it's reopened now, it's functional again. Especially in Gaza, unfortunately, health infrastructure is very frequently damaged and targeted. So they have a lot of experience in rebuilding, somehow, despite Israel really heavily limiting the supply of construction materials, they're very, they tend to be very quick in rebuilding, of managing this, repeated, damaging to their infrastructure. So, thankfully it's back up and running, it looks like, cases are not, there's still cases, they're not as, they're slowly coming down. So that's a positive sign at the moment in terms of Palestine. In terms of Gaza specifically, I'm not sure about the current situation of the number of cases in Gaza and whether they're climbing or not. But, having a working test center is absolutely essential to know that and to plan the response. And also note that the doctor at Al Shifa Hospital that was coordinating the COVID response for the Gaza Strip was killed in an attack in a residential building by an Israeli airstrike. So it's it goes beyond just damaging the infrastructure. It's also killing the people. You have doctors that have died, and not just someone that's working, but coordinating COVID-19 response. You know, obviously, will have a huge impact.
I think also it restricts the movement even further of Palestinians coming in and out of Israel for all like different between towns. Has that been like because obviously you have like you're obviously with COVID-19 it was restricting of movement and of individuals. Has that been an issue? Has that also like restricted their ability to get aid as well? Did you get what I'm saying? Like if you have for example, like a self-imposed lockdown and isolation, how does that further affect the way people? Because obviously, it affect the way people receive treatment and care. From different organizations, because it's not just healthcare professionals. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, so yeah, absolutely. It does contribute.
So I guess it's also the kind of NGOs that are trying to support the Palestinians. So NGOs, there are various NGOs that we're familiar with that work with Palestine and provide aid, medical assistance or other kind of assistance. That's probably what we're kind of...
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I think that the before the pandemic, it was already very difficult to get places for medical treatment. So, for example, there's no children's dialysis center in Gaza. So in order for a child to receive dialysis, they have to go to Jerusalem. So they're not asking to go to Tel Aviv, right? They're asking to go to East Jerusalem, which is a Palestinian territory under Israeli occupation and control. So for them to go to the dialysis unit, it's a very long trek, but also checkpoints frequently along the route. And for them to have any adult accompanying them is actually quite difficult. So you have to apply for a permit. You only find out if the permit's going to be accepted like 2 days before. Permits get rejected all the time. Children go on their own to another city, what may as well be another country, on a regular basis. And during COVID, what was especially heartbreaking was that you had children in ITUs in Jerusalem that died alone because their parents were not allowed to visit, were not granted permits to come and see their child that was dying. And it's not like they died suddenly. It was a slow deterioration, and yet they were still not allowed to come and see and to be there with their child as they died. So it's a brutal system, and it's a really just dehumanizing on every level. And preventing access to healthcare is it's a crime against humanity, and yet it seems systemic in how the system is built up, how Israel has occupied these Palestinian territories.
Right, and is there any issues with like the water at all, water shortages or anything like that, access to water? I know that they have Israel and Palestine has a long discussion. A long ongoing conflict going on with the Golan Heights. Does the Golan Heights, I remember reading about it ages ago now, so back when I was doing my A-levels. But is there something still going on in terms of Golan Heights, and is that affecting Palestine?
I don't know. it's a short answer.
Is that too far-fetched?
Palestinians generally have a struggle to get clean water. So in Gaza, Israel essentially controls how much water they receive, and is often limited, very limited. And in the West Bank, because of how settlements have set up, when a settlement pops up in Palestinian land around the settlement, it's cut up and fragmented. To allow the settlement to thrive. And essentially, when a settlement is built, it takes water that would be going to Palestinian areas. And so they are able to build infrastructure that connects all of the settlements together away from Palestinians. And Palestinians have to live with the consequences of, you know, these new settlements that cut directly in between their lands and prevents them from building infrastructure to allow water and irrigation and, you know, clean water and electricity, etc., all of those things. So absolutely, it's an ongoing struggle for water and for sanitation. Unfortunately, Palestinian children especially have a, I think, you know, in terms of infant mortality, 45% of infant mortality in Palestine is due to preventable infectious disease. So this is all stuff that can be treated with good sanitation, with good clean water, with access to primary services or primary care services, with a health infrastructure, and it's just not happening. There's a big, big gap in the difference between the healthcare systems and the provision of services from water to health in Israel and Palestine.
Okay, brilliant. I guess you've answered my question the way I was kind of, yeah, that's exactly what I was kind of asking. So we're going to wrap up. It's been interesting to have this conversation with you. Thank you so much, Dr. Yusuf, for joining us. Before we let you go, I wanted to ask, some of our listeners may or may not know how to support the Palestinians if they wanted to. So is there, what could we do? You know, we're in England here. We're not really able to go and help them physically, but is there some way that we can actually help them in terms of supporting charities or anything like that you can kind of
shed some light on, maybe? Yes, absolutely. So there's a lot that you can do. And the first step is learning more, is reading more. It's doing your own research. It's understanding just the extent of the problems and how they can affect individuals and families and communities and the whole the whole Palestine. The first step to addressing anything is understanding the problem itself. Second, I think that there are some incredible organizations that do really, really good work. So organizations such as Medical Aid for Palestinians, the Palestinian Red Crescent, all do really incredible work. So for example, the Palestinian Red Crescent is a sort of helps provide pre-hospital treatment and paramedics and ambulances to Palestinians, and they've developed some incredible things to come basically to overcome or to try and mitigate against the problems with checkpoints, etc. And so read up on what they've been doing support them, support Medical Aid for Palestinians. You can also get involved with your local hospital as well. So there's infrastructure, you know, when our hospitals, you know, their computers get too old or whatever, or they're upgrading something or other, they can often send the old infrastructure to hospitals that might need them. So if you work in a hospital or if you have contacts in a hospital, you can encourage them to send some of this, you know, computers or whatever, or, you know, medical devices that have been upgraded. You can send the old ones to Palestine rather than throwing them in the bin. Praying for the situation, praying for justice, praying for a resolution that, you know, protects people, protects children, protects, the rights of all people to live in dignity and happiness and without fear. And, it's a sad situation, but there is a lot that can be done about it. So do something.
Amazing. Yeah, it's a very dire situation indeed. Thank you for sharing.
Especially
the last one
about
the hospitals.
Yeah.
And being able to, that was very interesting. Yeah, exactly. Because we always hear about, you know, aid and charities and supporting, which is very important as well, but the hospital support with the devices and the laptops and computers and that stuff is quite interesting. Definitely. Thank you so much, Dr. Yusuf. It's been incredible to learn some more about Palestine. Also, you mentioned about social media and also learning about them. And I just want to quickly pick up on that, actually. We know that social media has become media, essentially, for the Palestinians, and us sharing so much online has been very effective with lots of people knowing about the situation now, thankfully, due to this. As we know, mainstream media doesn't cover it as much. and they've got an agenda of their own. But yeah, just that, the whole idea of like just sharing and learning more, whether that's reading articles, reading books on the crisis. It's been an ongoing crisis, so there's loads and loads of literature out there, of course. And then there's the power of social media, sharing with your friends, family, and talking about it, just discussing it at home, which is essentially increasing knowledge and raising awareness about this, and listening to podcasts like these. So amazing. Thank you so much. I think I've learned a lot from this as well. And I'm sure Nusra has as well. Nusra, have you got anything else to add?
I completely agree with all the points that you were saying. And I think with social media, it is really like there's so much to learn. And I think following accounts following people who are like people, we have so many different activists like the Al-Kurd siblings, and keeping in touch in base with people within Palestine and how they choose to represent, using them as direct forms of journalism within Palestine, and being conscious that there are alternatives to obviously there's a lot of information to sift through, but there's so many amazing native Palestinians, and also people like Dr. Yusuf doing work. So just make an effort just to follow them, just having your daily, even if it's an everyday tweet, it really does keep you tuned in more than a lot of people imagine. So this is just me advertising, getting on Twitter and following all these people. But yeah, I think it really does keep you in tune and listen to podcasts and etc. Yeah. So yeah, that's all I have to say. But it's been a lovely having you on this podcast. I've definitely learned a lot. I feel like for me, I've always been quite caught up in the history and more of the political side of it all, and economic side. That's where it's really easy to access. But for other people who are in different disciplines, particularly medicine, etc., it's a really nice way to link what they're studying to something so important. Yeah,
I totally agree. This is like completely different because you always hear about the politics of it. And you hear the economic implications, but hearing it from a global health angle is actually quite interesting. I agree. So thank you so much, Dr. Yusuf. We're not going to take any more time from your busy schedule. It's been a pleasure.
Thank
you
very much.
Board.
If I can just add something, first of all, it's been an absolute pleasure being on this podcast, and I hope that. Your listeners have learned something, or has reignited a passion to look into some of these health problems faced by Palestinians. I just wanted to highlight someone in particular that I personally find inspirational, and I would like all of your recent listeners, if they're not aware of them, to read on their story. And it's of Razan El Najjar, who's a 21-year-old volunteer paramedic from Gaza and a medical student. So she works as a nurse and was studying to do medicine. And in 2018, unfortunately, whilst administering medical aid to Palestinians that were protesting in 2018, she was killed by Israeli military forces. So she is incredible, and you hear the things that she said about why she does what she does, and just how strong she is, incredibly inspiring, and I think is a role model for, or can act as a role model for anyone, especially those who are interested in healthcare and in health. So please read her story. Please also read the story of other Palestinians. It would be fantastic if you can get a Palestinian to come and give their own lived experiences and the experiences of their families of accessing health services in Palestine as well. Don't forget the people that are involved in this either.
Brilliant. I've noted it down, so yeah, I'll definitely have a look at that. Thank you. And we're going to leave it. Thank you.